Case number 20-5299, D'Angelo Moody versus Mike Paris. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Teeter for the appellant.
Okay, good afternoon, Ms. Teeter. You may proceed. I understand you wish to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Elizabeth Teeter, pro bono counsel for appellant D'Angelo Moody. Before I begin, I'd like to thank the court for allowing Mr. Moody a further opportunity to present oral argument. The main claim that I intend to focus today on is Moody's ineffective assistance of counsel claim based on his trial counsel, Mark Kovacs, failure to interview and call at trial Ortego Thomas. Thomas was a key eyewitness in the case who was in the car at the time of the shooting and would have spoken directly to Moody's lack of involvement in the shooting. If the court has any questions about Moody's actual innocence claim, I'm happy to answer those questions as well. Moving to Moody's ineffective assistance of counsel claim, Strickland has two prongs, deficiency and prejudice. As your honors may recall, we were talking about the issue of prejudice the last time we were together. With respect to prejudice, the TCCA wrongly found that Kovacs' failure to
Can I ask you a question about the deficiency? One of the things that the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals said was that there was no evidence that Kovac knew that Thomas would have testified favorably for Moody. Is that correct? And is, I guess your argument is he should have interviewed him regardless?
That's correct, Your Honor. Kovac did testify at the post-conviction hearing that no one told him that Thomas was willing to testify and that he believed that Thomas was not willing to testify. But that was erroneous because Kovac's subjective belief that Thomas was not willing to testify was based on pure speculation. It wasn't based on anything other than the fact that Thomas severed his case from Moody. And as this court made clear in Ramones, counsel can't guess what a witness will or will not say without investigating.
But there was no, I guess there was no reason for him to believe that Thomas was going to testify favorably. In other words, the trial court, it seemed to me that the trial court thought that there was evidence that Kovac knew that there was this possibility of favorable testimony. And the Court of Criminal Appeals says, no, there's no indication that it was ever communicated to him by Thomas or Moody or Thomas's attorney or anyone that yes, he's willing to testify. So I don't know. I mean, why is he not making a judgment at that point based on what he knows? And why isn't that reasonable for that attorney?
Your Honor, Ramones makes clear that counsel has to make reasonable efforts to interview key eyewitnesses before coming to an ultimate choice about trial conduct. So Kovac couldn't have made an informed decision about what Thomas would or would not say and whether he was willing to testify without talking to him first.
What did his counsel say? What did Thomas's counsel say to Kovac?
Your Honor, Kovac, during the post-conviction testimony, that is what is before the evidence that was before the TCCA. Kovac said that Ms. Preston, who was Thomas's attorney, never affirmatively told him that Thomas was willing to testify. But we actually do have a declaration in the district court record from Ms. Thomas that was not considered by the TCCA, not Ms. Thomas, excuse me, Ms. Preston. So it was after the fact, but she did submit a sworn declaration saying that she did tell Kovac that her client was willing to testify on his behalf. So in that case, either way, Kovac was deficient because if he didn't know that Thomas was willing to testify, he was deficient for not following up and not interviewing key witnesses. And if he did know from Ms. Preston, then he was deficient for knowing that there was a key witness who was willing to testify on his behalf, on his client's behalf, and not doing anything about it.
Do we know why the declaration was not considered by the TCCA? That the declaration was dated in time before the TCCA decision, or is it afterwards?
It was after, Your Honor. It was actually a declaration that we obtained as part of the district court proceeding. So it was not before the TCCA at the time.
Okay. Well, how should this declaration be, to what extent is it a part of this record, I suppose, is the question.
Your Honor, it was not before the TCCA at the time. But we think that even without the declaration, it still shows Mr. Kovac's deficiency, because even without the declaration, even if he didn't have any knowledge, any affirmative knowledge about what Thomas would or would not have said, under Ramones, he had an affirmative duty to go out and seek that information. And it was obvious that Mr. Thomas was a key eyewitness because he was one of the only people in the car at the time of the shooting. And he was also a known witness because he was a charged co-defendant in the case.
Are you allowed to just interview a co-defendant that you know is represented by counsel? Was he permitted to just call him up and say, what do you know about the case?
No, Your Honor. What Kovac should have done is walked across the hall to the office space that he shared with Thomas's attorney and asked her if her client was willing to testify, but he didn't even do that. So in other cases where they found deficiency, there was a much higher burden for the attorney to talk to a witness. But here it was almost as if Thomas was handed to him on a silver platter. And he still didn't do anything, which makes the deficiency even more glaring.
But that's what I'm curious about, whether he was handed to him on a silver platter or not. That kind of assumes that he knew that he was going to give exculpatory testimony or knew what his testimony was. I mean, he's a co-defendant. He's going to trial somewhere down the road. This case is going to go to trial first. Why would he have reason to believe that he was going to get favorable testimony from this co-defendant?
He needed to investigate one way or the other. Even if he wouldn't have gotten favorable testimony from Thomas, he could have gotten information, because regardless of whether Thomas was willing to testify for Moody, he was an eyewitness in the car.
Is there a blanket duty on the part of an attorney under Strickland to interview every witness? I mean, is there a Supreme Court case that says that? Because we're looking for clearly established Supreme Court law, right?
Your Honor, that's correct, but we're not asking for a per se rule. This court made clear in Poindexter that the Strickland analysis is context dependent, but we're saying that in this particular context, the state's ability to establish criminal responsibility rested entirely on the testimony of one eyewitness, that was Caldwell, who himself had credibility issues. So surely in a case about a drive-by shooting, a defense attorney has ample reasons to talk to the other people in the car.
Now, if you were counsel for your client here, would you have just gone across the hall and asked counsel for this witness, what does your witness know? And is he going to testify? You think he should ask that? And if you were counsel for this witness, you just tell him not to say anything to counsel, wouldn't you? That would be my idea about it.
Your Honor, that's making assumptions. What we have in the record is that Thomas was willing to testify and that he communicated before he pleaded guilty, he communicated to his attorney that he wanted to testify on Moody's behalf. So if Kovac had gone across the hall and asked Ms. Preston, at least even if she would have advised her client not to testify, she should have at least she would have at least had to tell him that my client has information that is relevant to your client's case. And if you want to set up an interview, I'll facilitate that.
She wouldn't have to do that, though, would she?
She wouldn't have to do that, but as we know in her declaration in the district court proceedings, which were submitted later on, under oath, she swore that she had communicated that to Mr. Kovac.
Yeah. When did you find that? Was it before the trial, or was it after the trial, or when?
I'm not sure of exact. That's not true. Excuse me, Your Honor. It was before the trial. According to Ms. Preston, she communicated that before the trial, and according to Mr. Thomas, he communicated that to her before the trial.
Even if you can show deficiency, it seems that prejudice would be a pretty uphill battle. Parties have briefed this issue. What's your strongest, argument that there's prejudice here, given that the jury found that Mr. Moody did not possess the gun, maybe presumably did not shoot a gun, but they could find him guilty if he directed or participated in, I would think, in the shooting.
Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You may answer the question.
Okay. With respect to your question, we actually think there are three reasons why it's prejudicial. I'm happy to go on into this.
If you could just very, very briefly.
Very briefly, the TCCA unreasonably found there was no prejudice because the jury wouldn't have credited Thomas's testimony because it was subject to impeachment. Under Bigelow, conflicting testimony between two eyewitnesses is enough to establish prejudice. Additionally, Thomas would have testified to additional things other than saying that Moody didn't have a gun. He also would have said that Moody didn't say anything before the shooting and that he wasn't giving directions.
Okay, and I've got one other question for you. Our court entered an order, I think, in mid-December. In another case involving Mr. Moody. Are you familiar with that or involved in that case?
I am, Your Honor, in both.
Okay. Where does that case stand? I know that we remanded a matter to the district court, presumably involving this actual innocence claim.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court had concluded that Moody's actual innocence claim was a second and successive habeas petition that required permission from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals to go forward. We argued before the Sixth Circuit that was actually not, it was not a second and successive petition because it was procedural. It was not, the decision was not on the merits. Sixth Circuit agreed with us and remanded to the district court to consider that claim. And the district court has not issued a decision in that claim yet.
How does that impact the actual innocence issue you have in this case?
Your Honor, it doesn't actually impact anything. If anything, it would only strengthen because there's additional evidence that was not brought in this appeal that was brought in that appeal of Moody's actual innocence, namely Caldwell's complete recantation of his testimony.
Okay. Thank you. You'll have your 5 minutes of rebuttal. Mr. Stahl?
Your Honors.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Michael Stahl for the state. Your Honors, the petitioner's argument embraces a common misconception on federal habeas review. That is, his dissatisfaction with the state court judgment is enough to render its reversal on review. But as this court well knows, that argument fails. Under the proper standard, firstly, the petitioner presents no Supreme Court precedent, which would indicate that the state court judgment here was contrary to federal law. So the petitioner is only left with a reasonableness argument. But the petitioner in reviewing whether or not the state court's judgment was objectively reasonable, wants this court to only consider one fact, that Ortego Thomas did not testify in petitioner's trial. But when all the facts are considered in this case, there can be no doubt that the state court's judgment was objectively reasonable. First, the situation and the facts show that the petitioner drove his car to pick up his half-brothers along with several other members of the vehicle, some charged co-defendants, some not. At least two of those individuals had guns with them. At least one of those individuals admitted to police that he was a member of a rival gang, whereas the intended target was part of another gang. While they were driving around.
Let me ask you this. Can I ask you this question? If Moody, assume for a second that he's not a shooter, what would be the actus reus that would get you to criminal responsibility? This is a sufficiency question.
We have to remember that in Tennessee, criminal responsibility can be inferred by presence, companionship, or conduct before or after the crime. So first of all, there's no argument that Moody was present during the crime. Second of all, it was his vehicle and he drove and picked up everybody in his own car. Now he moved to the back seat, which the jury could have inferred was an opportunity for him to help look for the intended targets while they were driving around. Two of the individuals in the car had guns at the time of the shooting and at the time Mr. Moody picked them up. One of the individuals in the car then shouts out, there goes C-trigger or the intended target, and the car immediately turns around and fires. So not only does criminal intent only require presence and companionship.
Well, the way I read the cases, and maybe I'm wrong, you can infer his intent, I guess, from presence, but doesn't he have to actually assist? Like, doesn't he actually have to do something? Like, I think of it as kind of a mens rea and an actus reus. Like, what did he actually do? Is it sufficient that he got out of the driver's seat and therefore was, you could infer that he was acting like as a lookout or something? Like, he's not the one that shouted out, there go the guys that we're beefing with, right? I mean, I don't think anybody testified to that. And
no, you are.
He may or may not have been a shooter. I mean, that I think I said this the last time we were here, the direct appeal in this case, that it was sufficient, there was sufficient evidence, the court said that he was a shooter because Caldwell said he was a shooter. So, and obviously it's an inconsistent verdict perhaps that he was acquitted on the gun charge, but we don't review inconsistent verdicts except in very limited circumstances. So maybe he is a shooter, maybe that's enough. But taking the shooter off, I'm struggling with what else is it? Is it just he owns the car or his mom owns the car? He changed seats. Is that it? I mean, what else do we have?
Well, to answer Your Honor's first question, that it is enough for presence and companionship to infer criminal responsibility. So the actus reus that's required is a lower level than I think what the court is assuming, in that there has to be an overt action to indicate a desire to participate in the charged crime. So that low burden was met in this case. And whether or not the higher burden is met and whether or not there was an overt action on the part of Moody, that can be inferred by the two things the court noticed. First of all, he drove to pick everyone up in his car. Second of all, he moves himself into the back seat so that ostensibly he can help look for the intended targets. And then thirdly, when it was called out that the targets were within view and the car immediately turns around, there was no overt action on his part to not have everybody shoot if he wasn't the shooter himself. And there was testimony that he participated in the shooting. So You have quite a bit there for the jury to have found that he was criminally responsible right. for.
So let me ask you this, because obviously it's not really a sufficiency case right now. It's a Strickland case. So, but I think the quantum of evidence is relevant to whether Thomas's testimony would have made a difference in terms of Strickland prejudice. So let's assume you're right. There's probably enough there, but it's not a really, really strong case in my mind. Why wouldn't the Thomas testimony have then been very relevant, or at least possibly could have turned the tide? I know that's not the standard, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, why isn't it that the Thomas testimony becomes really important given the lack of really great evidence here if he's not a shooter?
Because Thomas's testimony could not have indicated what Moody knew or did not know. At best, he could only testify to objective facts. And the only objective fact he could have testified to was that Moody was not, in fact, a shooter. Other than that, his speculative testimony as to what Moody did or did not know would be inadmissible. And so since the jury acquitted Mr. Moody on the gun charge, it already accepted that he was not a shooter. So there's nothing left for Ortega Thomas to give to the jury aside from his own speculative and inadmissible thoughts on what Moody may have known in his own mind at the time of the shooting. And so counsel knew that. And that's why counsel alerted the post-conviction court to the fact that he was never told that Mr. Moody or Mr. Thomas was prepared to testify and throw himself at the mercy of the court, eschewing his Fifth Amendment rights. But also, even if he had, Mr. Thomas was asked during the post-conviction hearing if his testimony boiled down essentially to the fact that Mr. Moody did not have a gun during the shooting. And Mr. Thomas's response to that was yes. So because the jury acquitted him, because Moody's counsel knew that the evidence was already going to show in his mind that Mr. Moody was not a shooter, there could be no prejudice to not calling a witness who could only provide cumulative testimony. So at best, the testimony would have been cumulative. At worst, it would have been harmful. And it even worse than that, I suppose, it would have been inadmissible. So there's no prejudice here.
Let me ask this question. Was there a witness at the trial that said that Moody did have a firearm?
Yes, Your Honor. Quantes Caldwell, who was also in the car at the time, testified that Moody was one of the shooters at the time that the shots were fired.
Caldwell has since recanted, apparently.
Your Honor, yeah, I'd like to address that because the court has a lot of questions. I think Mr. Moody's brief has been a little bit misleading in that it continues to refer to facts that are outside the record and are not before this court. Under the standard that this court well knows on federal habeas review, only the facts that were before the state court at the time it rendered its decision are before this court. And Mr. Moody continues to indicate and bring to this court's attention facts that were not before the state court when it rendered its decision, that weren't brought to anyone's attention until a year and a half ago. So you're right, Your Honor, that has now been recanted. However, it's also notable that during that recantation testimony, the trial court at the state level discredited Caldwell's testimony. So it's very arguable whether or not that recantation matters. It's arguable whether or not the declaration that counsel was referring to earlier matters. But for the purposes of this hearing, it's inarguable that it doesn't matter at all because it cannot be considered by this court.
It sounds like this is something that may be part of this other case that's being remanded to the district court, based in part, apparently, on the Caldwell recantation.
It may be, and it may not be, Your Honor. Again, I mean, there's going to be some credibility determinations there and some findings of fact that are necessary. But what we're asking this court to do is affirm the district court's denial of habeas relief. And before the district court, there were none of these facts. So the district court already considered the petitioner's actual innocence argument and rejected it, as this court should as well. And so any further facts that are considered by the district court on remand for petitioner's newest Rule 56 motion should not be considered and does not impact the decision of this court whether or not to affirm the district court's judgment here. And so, yeah, there's a bit of a procedural quagmire that this case perhaps is involved in, but the cleanest and best route for this court to take right now would be to affirm the district court's denial of federal habeas appeal, because Mr. Moody, the state court judgment was not objectively unreasonable, and because the petitioner has not shown actual innocence to excuse the procedural default of his other claims. If the district court then, upon remand, were to consider additional facts, then that decision could come back to this court for a new review. But at this time, there's no reason for this court not to affirm the district court's denial of the claims that are before it now. And I would like to just take, I see I have a few more minutes, to address the petitioner's actual innocence claim. Because
I'm sorry, can I ask you a question about the deficiency prong? I am a little bit curious what your response is. I mean, why wasn't it reasonable to expect Kovac to just at least ask to interview Thomas? I mean, he is a witness. Why? The lawyers across the hall, wouldn't you just walk across the hall and say, hey, can I sit down with your client and see what he knows, with you present, obviously?
Well, to be clearer than I think opposing counsel was on this issue, Mr. Kovac was asked whether or not he spoke with Mr. Thomas's counsel about Mr. Thomas and this case. And he said, yes, on multiple occasions. They shared an office. They were very close. They knew each other. But it isn't clear exactly what words were used between the two attorneys. So it's all speculation to consider whether or not what the court just offered was in fact asked by Mr. Kovac to Ms. Preston. What we do know is that it was never indicated to him that Mr. Thomas had any intention to testify favorably, and that, in fact, the impression that he was given by Ms. Preston, Mr. Thomas's attorney, was that he was not going to testify favorably if he was called to testify. And so based on those facts, Mr. Moody's counsel recognized that pursuing any type of testimony from a charged co-defendant, hoping that that charged co-defendant would, on the witness stand, throw himself at the mercy of the jury and declare himself the sole shooter, was simply not practical. And as counsel indicated, he couldn't just walk up to Mr. Thomas and ask him himself. So he relied on Mrs. Preston's indications to him about the case. So exactly what was said between them.
But he had to know. I mean, didn't he have some indication that the state wanted another cooperating witness, or that they were gonna try to call Thomas, or he was on their list because he was an eyewitness, he was there. Caldwell wasn't a great witness, honestly. I mean, his testimony may be fine, but he had some credibility issues, and Thomas does too. But I mean, at that point, aren't you curious as the lawyer as to what this guy is going to say, why the state may or may not be calling him? I mean, I guess your point is it's just not in the record that he did or did not make these specific requests. But I guess if it's not in the record, then why wasn't it deficient? I mean, that he didn't, or he certainly didn't testify, as I read it, that he asked direct questions like, can I sit down with your client and find out what he's going to say?
That's right, Your Honor. But remember, we're not reviewing this de novo. So the factual findings of the TCCA are required to be adopted unless there's clear and convincing evidence otherwise. And the TCCA said that it's not deficient because he did not know. And there has been no other objective indication in the record that he did know. So it's not simply enough to say what he should have or what he shouldn't have done.
So I hear you, and I know. So they said yes. There's no indication that he knew that Thomas might testify favorably. In other words, there's no evidence that Moody or the family or somebody told him, "Hey, go talk to this guy." But putting that aside, why isn't there some investigative duty at some point? Even if he doesn't know the state of things, he's got an eyewitness who might be called at trial. Why doesn't he try to talk to that person? Why wouldn't a reasonable attorney representing their client try to figure out what the witnesses are going to say?
But I think the record indicates that that's exactly what he did do, Your Honor. He went to Mr. Thomas's counsel and he spoke with her on numerous occasions, specifically about the case. That's why he said it was indicated to him by Thomas's counsel that Thomas intended to not testify favorably or to invoke the Fifth Amendment. He said that because he did investigate and he did ask those questions. What the court is getting to is why didn't he do more, which is a question that Strickland answers by requiring deference to counsel's actions at the time. It's always 20/20 to say that counsel could have or should have done more. But in this situation, it was objectively reasonable for Mr. Moody's counsel to approach Thomas's counsel and say, "What are your thoughts on this case? What is your guy going to do? What does he know? What can I ask him?" Or anything of the like. Now, the specific question and answers weren't produced in the record, but it's safe to assume that that's exactly how those conversations went. And the indication was to him that Thomas was not going to be a favorable witness. And so he moved forward under that assumption. That is a reasonable investigation under just about any case law standard. Great. I see him out of time.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Saul. Ms. Teeter, you have 5 minutes.
Your Honors, I have two main points to make in rebuttal. First, with respect to the deficiency prong, Kovac's failure to interview Thomas was deficient because Kovac had an affirmative duty to interview Thomas. The reason that is just because Thomas was a key eyewitness in the case. This court's decision in Towns makes clear that an attorney has an obligation to interview all witnesses who have any information about their client's guilt or innocence. So even if hypothetically Thomas had bad information about Moody under Towns, Mr. Kovac would still have a duty to interview Mr. Thomas.
Towns is in some sense a good case for you, but I mean, A, it didn't really involve AEDPA deference, which I think is a big part of this case. And B, it's our case. It's not a Supreme Court case. So I'm still, under AEDPA, we've got to look at what the Supreme Court has said, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The clearly established federal law that we're relying on is Strickland. And the Sixth Circuit cases we are relying on are cases interpreting Strickland. But we cite to a number of cases in our brief where this court is applying Strickland with AEDPA deference and still holds that a failure to interview such as this one is deficient and prejudicial. For example, in Ramones, which was a 2254 case, the court found that failure to interview interested witnesses with inconsistencies in their testimony, in that case, it was the defendant's son and stepson, they found that was deficient and prejudicial. And then in Poindexter, which was a similar case, this court found that the failure to interview key witnesses who were available was also prejudicial. Here, Thomas was a key eyewitness because he was in the car. He was a known witness because he was a charged co-defendant, and he easily could have been contacted because Kovacs shared office space with him. So while we're relying on those state court's decisions, or it's, while we're relying on those decisions as evidence of what how this court has interpreted Strickland, the state court decisions in those cases were held to be unreasonable, not simply incorrect under AEDPA. So it wouldn't make sense if it were the rule in those cases, but not in this case, because we're in the exact same procedure, we're in the exact same posture.
Is there an AEDPA from the Supreme Court which requires counsel to interview a co-defendant who is under indictment getting ready to go to trial? Is there like that?
Your Honor, there is no per se rule about interviewing co-defendants, but there's also no per se rule saying that severed co-defendants cannot be interviewed. In this case, it's all context dependent under Poindexter. And in this case, in this context, Thomas was a key witness because he was in the car, and he was also a co-defendant because he was in the car. So we're not asking for a per se rule. We're asking for this court to understand the context and realize that Caldwell was the only one who offered any testimony at all against Moody in this case. And here, if Kovac had interviewed Thomas, he would have learned that there was another witness who had a very different story. And it would have boiled down to a credibility contest between Thomas and Caldwell. And there's at least a reasonable probability under Bigelow that it would have been that the jury verdict could have been different, which is all that's required in a Strickland prejudice determination. Additionally, with respect to the issue of prejudice, the TCA's another example of prejudice is the TCCA wrongly found that there was no prejudice because it found that Thomas's testimony was limited to saying that Moody didn't have a gun. But actually, this reading is at odds with other parts of the record. The criminal responsibility statute in Tennessee requires that a person solicit, direct, aid, or attempt to aid another person in committing the offense. And Thomas's proposed testimony would have shown that Moody did none of this. Specifically, it would have shown that Moody did not solicit or direct the shooting, because Thomas would have testified that Moody did not say anything before the shooting. He was not the one who said, "There goes someone me beefing with." And he would have also testified that it was not Moody, it was Caldwell who was giving directions. So there can be no inference that Moody was the one to direct the car to turn around. And there's no dispute among either side that Moody wasn't driving. So without that, he could not have aided in the shooting. And he also didn't have a gun, so he couldn't have aided in the shooting.
How does mere presence in the car factor into the criminal responsibility statute? I think I heard your brother counsel say that mere presence can lead to an inference by the jury of criminal responsibility.
Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You may answer.
Your Honor, taken to its logical conclusion, that would mean that anyone who was in the wrong place at the wrong time could always be held guilty under a theory of criminal responsibility. That doesn't make sense. The statute itself says there has to be some act. You have to direct, solicit, or aid. And Thomas's testimony really shows, very clearly shows that Moody did not take any act that would have suggested that he was criminally responsible.
But what about it was his car, right? I mean, why isn't that enough?
Your Honor, may I continue?
Yes, you may.
So the TCCA did point to the fact that the car was registered to Moody's mother, but it was never actually established at trial that the car used during the shooting was Moody's, because there was a number of inconsistent testimony presented at trial about the make and the color of the car. So there was some witnesses who said it was green. There were some who said it was blue. Some said it was an Impala. Some said it was a Honda.
Well, wait, you can't question. I mean, the trial is the trial. There was testimony that it was his car. the jury would be entitled to believe that. It wasn't really an element, right? I mean, it could have been as part of the criminal responsibility. I mean, we can't, I mean, Thomas wasn't going to testify that it wasn't Moody's car, was he? I mean, that's just a fact that, I mean, yeah, maybe there was conflicting evidence, but I mean, we have to go with what the jury did, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But this just demonstrates the weakness of the case against Moody. And under Bigelow, this court has made clear that the prejudice determination places considerable weight on the strength of the evidence that led to the conviction. So here, the evidence against Moody was far, far from overwhelming.
But what do we do with the fact that, I mean, there's still testimony that he was a shooter. I mean, that was sufficient. There's sufficient evidence that he was a shooter, right? Because an eyewitness said that he was shooting. And I understand that he was acquitted of the gun charge, but I go back to this idea that we can't really look at that. I mean, Judge Trauger mentioned that in her opinion. Look, it's an inconsistent verdict, but we don't know why juries acquit on one thing and convict on the other. We look at them separately in isolation and say, is there sufficient evidence? And here, I mean, there was testimony that he was a shooter. Why wouldn't that be enough?
Your Honor, to the extent the jury might have believed that Moody was actually the shooter based on Caldwell's testimony, then Thomas's testimony, if offered, would have refuted this because he would have testified that Moody wasn't the shooter. So that would mean that it would be even more prejudicial because they would have had, because Kovac would have been able to present an eyewitness with a competing version of events who said that Moody was not the shooter. So in either case, whether the jury held Moody guilty, found Moody guilty under a theory of criminal responsibility or as being the shooter, in either case, not calling Thomas was prejudicial.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take this case under advisement. Thank counsel for appearing today on this Zoom platform. And Ms. Teeter, we would like to thank you and your law firm for taking this matter under the Criminal Justice Act. It's a real service to our system at large and certainly to Mr. Moody. And we do appreciate that. Again, thanks to both counsel for your arguments. We'll take the case under submission. And Janine, you may adjourn court.